Chapter 3. Alit Orisha Taldin. Family is more than bloodline. Mandalorian proverb. The Skywalker's apartment. Coruscant. 0800 hours. Mara almost dropped her cup and steadied one hand on the table.
What's wrong?
Luke caught her shoulder and leaned over her. She began mopping spilled calf with her napkin, distracted.
Honey, are you okay?
Jason, she said.
Luke sought Ben in the Force immediately. He was there, with no hint of concern or danger. Jason, though, was not. There was nothing of him to detect.
He just blinked out, said Mara.
She opened her comlink.
I know he can do that when he wants to, but this felt weird.
She paused, eyes fixed in defocus at the far side of the room as she listened.
Ben? Ben, are you okay?
Yes.
Where's Jason? No, nothing important. Don't worry, I'll call you later.
Luke didn't hear Ben's response, but he was clearly at Jason's apartment as he was supposed to be, and unharmed. Mara stood up and pushed her hair back behind her ears, still looking distracted. She was far more attuned to Jason than Luke was, and he wondered if she kept tabs on her nephew as a precaution. That reassured him. Her old assassin habits hadn't died. They were still very much a part of her, adapted, pragmatic, and useful.
"Hello, Nat,"
she mumbled, and switched on the screen, looking for a news channel.
"I get the proverbial bad feeling about this. I just need to know what's going on."
She was right. Luke had begun to sense a welling anxiety and disturbance, a sense of something growing like a bank of storm clouds. While Mara made fresh calf, he wiped up the rest of the spill, watching her carefully. They were finishing breakfast when the HNE news flash announced that there'd been an explosion in the hotel district south of the summit. There was, said the hollow anchor, speculation that it was a bomb. Mara opened her comlink instantly, face set in blank concentration, and waited.
"Jason's not answering," she said.
It was easy to add two and two and reach a completely wrong total. Luke put his arm around her and squeezed.
"Now, be a simple explanation. It's a big planet, and the chances of his being caught up in that are remote."
"I tend to plan for worst scenarios," she said, and returned the hug. "And right now I've got no idea whether we should be looking for him or not."
Like all people used to being in control and taking action, Mara had that instinct to do something in a crisis, even if there was nothing obvious for her to do. Luke shared it.
"We can't stay out of it, even if we don't know what it is."
The Force didn't take a day off.
"If that really was a terrorist bomb," said Luke, "then we'd better head over to the summit, because Omas is going to want to discuss the implications."
Mara's blink rate had slowed right down, and she had gone quiet. He thought of it as her sniper mode— assessing, planning, coolly rational. He was always impressed that she could salvage the beneficial parts of her past life as an Imperial assassin and discard the darker aspects. But he was still glad they were on the same side. She grabbed a jacket, not one of her usual fashionable ones, but something gray and functional, as if preparing for combat.
"I hope nobody jumps to conclusions too fast. It's one of those things that could tip people here into doing something rash."
Luke wasn't sure if she meant politicians or citizens. Perhaps it didn't matter. One would trigger the other either way. He gestured toward the landing platform.
"I'll drive. You monitor the news."
HNE kept using the word explosion, and managed to make it sound like bomb every time. Luke tried to slip the airspeeder through the increasingly congested skylanes as traffic backed up from the scene of the explosion. It didn't take much to gridlock a crowded city that depended on tightly controlled transport. He glanced at Mara.
"What if it's not a bomb?"
"People jump to conclusions, If they want to believe it's a bomb, facts won't get in the way.
I can't imagine Corellia resorting to planting bombs in civilian areas.
Corellia,
Mara said. See, we all do it.
I thought of Corellia, too. We've got 1,000 species on Coruscant, and most of them have their dingbat element. It could be anybody.
Perception usually overrides facts.
You said it, sweetheart.
The speeder had slowed to a crawl in the traffic, as sky lanes above and below them backed up, too. Luke considered force-pushing his way between vessels, but there was simply no longer the maneuvering room to do that safely. He found the next public landing area and set the speeder down to continue the journey on foot. In theory, a pedestrian could cross the whole planet via walkways and streets. In reality, it was slow going. But it was useful to be close enough to people to get a sense of what they were feeling, and the overwhelming taste in the Force was mostly anger. It wasn't the political anger that emanated from Senate delegates. It was the personal, focused, fearful anger of people whose lives had been directly affected by a conflict on another planet. Coruscanti had been used to feeling safe for millennia. They were just getting used to being safe again, after the Yuuzhan Vong had been defeated, and now that fragile security had been shattered. It felt like a volcanic fissure opening the dark side. The air seemed charged. The object of that anger, whom people hated, whom they blamed, would affect the course of the conflict with Corellia. As Luke and Mara walked toward the Senate, the public holonews display screens were surrounded by people staring up at the unfolding news, grim-faced. The display showed which parts of Galactic City had now been sealed off, and harassed fire service officers explaining that they still hadn't reached the seat of the blast or assessed the total number of casualties. Luke paused behind them. Mara carried on and disappeared into the crowd. Nobody recognized them. That might have been a blessing.
"Has anyone claimed responsibility yet?" he asked.
A young man in a delivery pilot's yellow coverall half turned to him.
"No, but they don't need to, do they?"
"They?"
The man's gaze darted back to the screen.
"Corellia. Retaliation for Centerpoint, isn't it? Obvious."
Luke bit back a response and simply carried on walking. He caught up with Mara, who was waiting in a doorway and talking to someone on her comlink. She looked up and shook her head at him.
105 dead so far, and rising. 300 injured. I just called Omis's office. They've declared an emergency.
Must have been a big device, judging by the damage.
You don't need much to do a lot of damage in a crowded city made of towers.
Transparisteel blown out like a million blades, speeders falling thousands of meters, shockwaves concentrated on buildings by the canyons. Luke could guess at the details. The Force around him felt in turmoil, but most of it seemed to be coming from the people nearby. He took Mara's arm and pressed on through the crowds. It took them half an hour to reach the Senate, and Omis had already left the chamber to visit the Emergency Response Command Center deep below ground level. Luke and Mara walked into a huge room that appeared to be one large holodisplay packed with uniformed officers. The sign above the doors simply said, Strategic Center. This was where joint Galactic City authorities managed the longer-term effects of an incident, planning for what was needed in the days that followed, while the minute-to-minute work went on at the tactical and operational command centers down the chain. When Luke concentrated on what he had walked into, he realized that every branch of the city's emergency services had personnel there. He recognized Coruscant Security Force, Fire and Rescue, Air Traffic Control, Med Center managers, and the city authority. Omis stood talking to a young CSF captain in front of a data display. When Luke walked up behind them, he saw they were looking at a changing list of casualties. The entire wall was a mass of status boards, from lists of sky lanes that had been rerouted to which med centers were receiving the injured.
Omis turned to Luke and Mara and shook his head.
"We can rule out an accidental explosion," he said. "CSF picked up traces of commercial-grade detonite."
Mara maintained her detachment, her gaze tilted up and down the casualty list. Mostly unnamed, just descriptions, and Luke wondered if she was looking for Jason among them.
"Where was it placed?" Luke asked.
"In one of the hotels," said the CSF officer.
The ID tab on his tunic said Chevu.
"The elite. There's no obvious motive for the location, but it looks as if it detonated in a guest room. Might have been an own goal."
"Own goal?
Blew up while the terrorist was handling it.
So we have a room to go on.
Then we ought to have an identity for the guest.
We're checking that out.
We can't afford to guess at this." Captain Chevu looked down his nose at Luke, polite but clearly irritated by the suggestion.
"I don't guess about anything, sir. We're working with hard information that's coming in from tactical and operational. And where there are gaps, they stay as gaps until we have data."
"And what will our response be if this turns out to be Corellians?"
Omis seemed to take exceptional interest in a status board showing the list of premises affected by the explosion with red points of light, indicating whether they had been checked and secured yet.
"If this isn't shown beyond doubt to be the responsibility of the Corellian government, then our response must be to treat it as any other crime."
"I think Master Skywalker means the less formal response," said a voice behind Luke.
He hadn't even felt Jason enter the room. The fact that Jason could startle him was disturbing. Mara turned too, and even though Jason was standing there in front of them, Luke couldn't feel him. And, judging by her expression and her little flare of anxiety in the Force, Mara couldn't either. Then, like scent suddenly wafting up from a blossom, Jason's presence was there, all around them, magnified.
"So he wants to show me how powerful he is."
Luke regretted the hostility in his thoughts, but it did nothing to reassure him.
"Sorry, Uncle," said Jason.
The tension was, of course, invisible to a room full of non-Jedi.
"I got caught up in the blast. I came to see what I could do."
"I'm glad you're okay,"
Luke picked up on his original question.
"Yes, Captain. I mean the informal response. Retaliation. Escalation."
"Victimization," Chevu suggested quietly, still watching the status boards. "That'll make life in the city very awkward. Latest tally from Immigration Control says we have nearly 20 million Corellians living here."
"Most of whom are harmless," said Luke.
"And not easy to identify except by ID docs," said Jason. "They look just like us."
"They are just like us."
Omis put his hand on Jason's shoulder and steered the conversation into calmer waters with the ease of a professional statesman.
"Shall we continue this discussion elsewhere? We're getting in Captain Chevu's way. He has an incident to manage."
He gestured to one of the dozen small rooms off the main chamber, each marked with a board above the doors. Fire and Rescue Cell, CSF Cell, Med Service Cell. Omis ushered Mara, Luke, and Jason toward a room marked Information Cell.
"I'd like to discuss how we handle this with our public affairs people. Perception at times like this is everything. It's the difference between 100 dead in a speeder bus crash and 100 dead in a terrorist attack. One is a tragedy and the other is the beginning of a war."
Luke glanced at Mara, who met his eyes but showed no outward sign of her anxiety. Most of the troubles they had faced in their lives had been big, truly big. Invasions, alien armies, dark Jedi, each of them well beyond the scope of tidy incident management by Coruscant's civil servants. This was a small event in global terms, but like a snake bite, small, painful, and with the potential to poison a whole planet. Jason walked ahead of them, his presence in the Force betraying nothing but calm determination. Upper City Terrace. Boba Fett didn't care if anyone recognized Slave One as his ship. There wasn't much they could do about it. Stealth was fine in its place, but he didn't have to hide. And the restored shell of once glorious Terrace was so far off the beaten track these days that there really was a chance that nobody here knew who he was. It was a useful base for the time being. The galaxy seemed to have forgotten it existed, which was no bad thing, seeing as it had been razed to the ground 4 millennia ago in the Jedi Civil Wars. Fett savored the irony. He'd come to think of most galactic wars as Jedi feuds, because they almost always came down to Jedi versus Sith. The Yuuzhan Vong had almost been a refreshing interlude.
Things never change, do they?
He also found it interesting that the total restoration of a ravaged planet resulted in pretty much the same social order as before, the world once again reflecting the huge gulf between its classes in literal architectural levels.
People never learn, either.
He set the defense shield on Slave One and walked along the promenade, drawing cautious glances from some of the smartly dressed residents out for their evening stroll. The upper city was again an echo of Coruscant, soaring towers inhabited by the solidly rich. The lower city was a cesspit, and the subterranean levels, well, he vaguely recalled pursuing a bounty down there years ago, and it had been very ugly, even for a man who had seen the ugliest of the galaxy's faces.
"Anyone who wants me to go down there again can pay triple."
The thought caught him off guard. It was the sort of vague future plan that was beyond a dying man. Goran Bevine was waiting for him at the plush Horizon Hotel. He sat at the bar with a large mug of Teresian ale and a bowl of something that might have been deep-fried crustaceans of some kind. He had almost deferred to the bar's dress code. His helmet was placed on the bar beside him. But in his deep blue, battle-scarred Mandalorian armor, he still didn't fit in among the beautifully dressed patrons. Fett walked up behind him.
"You always sit with your back to the doors."
Bevine turned, apparently not startled to hear the voice of his Mandalore, ruler of the clans, commander of super commandos. Fett had never quite come to terms with his peacetime role.
"When I've assessed the risk, yes."
He looked at Fett's helmet with slow deliberation.
"Can I get you an ale and a drinking straw?"
"You're a riot. What are those?"
Bevine popped one of the fried things in his mouth and crunched with exaggerated relish.
"Coin crabs. Reminds me of those happy days we spent frying Yuuzhan Vong."
"Sentimentalist."
Bevine gestured around at polished wood and expensive upholstery.
"This is pretty comfortable. I always think of Terrace as a dead world."
"Maybe that's why I feel a kinship with it."
"What?"
"People often think I'm dead, too."
The quip didn't seem quite as amusing now. There was no point telling anyone else about his condition, not yet, and maybe never.
"So what have you got for me?"
Fett sat down on the stool next to Bevine, adjusting his holster carefully. The bartender, a middle-aged human male, whose high-collared uniform looked as expensive as his customer's evening dress, had a question forming on nervous lips. Fett knew it was probably a reminder that Sir should remove his helmet. He turned his head so that it was clear he was staring at the man through his visor, and waited for him to change his mind. He did. Fett turned back to Bevine.
"Get on with it."
"Thraken Sal Solo approached me with a contract on the whole Solo family."
"You know, I'd really like an ale now." "Relax. Never done that. Not like ordinary people."
"Direct?"
"Via an intermediary. But he forgets how good my comlink surveillance skills are.
and my contacts, of course.
"Wonder why he didn't ask me to go after Solo,"
said Fed. He considered the coin crabs and thought better of it.
Everyone else did.
"Maybe he thinks you'd be bored with it. And too expensive."
"Right on both counts."
Han Solo was irrelevant now. Truly irrelevant. Fett had never had a feud with him anyway. Just a string of contracts, and contracts were never personal. So?
"So I hear he's had a few takers."
"Not you."
"I don't do families. I only hunt criminals. I don't want to be one."
"I'm still waiting."
"Okay. Word is that Aylin's back and interested in the contract, too."
Fett was glad of the privacy of his helmet. He rarely registered surprise, because there was almost nothing left in the galaxy that could surprise him. But this felt suddenly raw, even after decades. His only child was alive. He'd heard nothing of her since the Yuuzhan Vong invasion, when billions had lost their lives. How old would she be now? 54? 55?
"Somehow I knew she wasn't dead." "It beats her taking a contract on me."
His stomach chilled.
"No, you don't mean that at all. You mean that she's your daughter, however much she hates you. However much she blames you for her mother's death, and you're dying, and you want to see her one last time. She's all you'll leave behind to prove that you ever existed." "Who else knows?"
Bevin, late 50s, gray-haired, but with a grin that made him look like a mischievous kid, seemed to be staring into his eyes, concerned. Fett's helmet never appeared to be a barrier for Mandalorians. Somehow they looked straight into the core of him.
"I thought nobody did, because she's calling herself Aylin Habur."
Fett waited. Bevin took a pull of his ale and said nothing.
"So what makes you think she's Aylin Vel?"
"My source tells me she's about 50, has a Kifar facial tattoo, and flies a KDY assault ship that I think you'd recognize. But I don't think that means much to anyone else these days."
His daughter had hated him enough to kill him and take his ship and armor. At least that's what she'd thought had happened. Had she ever found out she'd killed a clone instead? Fett had managed to shrug off the news at the time. It was more than 20 years ago, but it felt different now. He wanted to know where she had been, what she had done. But it was stupid and irrelevant, and far too late. He put the impulse aside.
"I hope she's careful, then," he said.
Bevin was waiting for more reaction, eyebrows raised, but he wasn't going to get it.
"Is that all?"
"Yes. I'm more interested in Kaminoans. What do you know about Kosai?"
"Apart from the rumors."
"I'll take rumors right now."
"They said she was killed during the Battle of Kamino. But the general view was that she defected to the Separatists. Then there's a big black hole, and the next rumor is that someone sent her back to Kamino."
"I'd have known if..."
"A piece at a time."
"What?"
"Body parts. Well, some of them."
"Only kidnappers did that kind of thing. They did it for credits, and that didn't fit a wartime defection at all. So that was how Koane knew someone had located Kosai."
"Fingers?"
"That was the usual removable body part of choice if a kidnapper wanted to focus someone's mind."
"Kaminoans don't have external ears."
"Not exactly. Parts she really needed, or so I hear."
Fett tried to imagine what the scientist could have done to end up dead and dissected. Maybe she'd tried to withhold her data. But why send the parts back to Kamino unless whoever held her wanted to pressure her government or teach them a lesson? And the data had never been sold. It would have been in use by now if it had. And as far as he could tell, the Kaminoans had never been asked to surrender anything, credits or data, in exchange.
That sounded like revenge, and that didn't help him find what he was looking for.
"Why are you interested in a disappearance that long ago?"
Bevine asked. "If anyone wants you to find the rest of her, it's a bit late." This was where things became uncertain for Fett. He had trusted only his father, who had put every scrap of his energy into making his son totally self-reliant. Boba Fett hunted alone. But from time to time, he was reminded that he was also the Mandalore. He had a responsibility to 100 warriors, and, this was the aspect that gave him the problem, a nation that wasn't only geographic, but a nomadic culture, too, except that it had a homeworld and a sector and... No, it wasn't clear at all. He wasn't sure what being Mandalore meant anymore. And he wondered if he thought of himself as Mandalorian first and bounty hunter second. He didn't.
Verd Orishia Beskargam.
Bevin took a pull at his ale.
A warrior is more than one's armor.
Fett rounded on him. What?
Aelin. Wearing your armor. Flying your ship. No substitute for a fighting spirit.
Bevin never appeared to fear him and never called him sir. A traditional Mandalorian never would, of course.
You still don't speak Mandoan, do you?
Basic and Huttese, that's what I do business in.
Maybe we need a little less business and a little more Mandalore, Bobica.
Bobica. Some of his father's associates had called him that as a kid. His father never had, but he ignored the over-familiar form of his name. I'm busy right now.
Nothing else you want done?
No.
I'd better be going. Just call if you have orders for me.
Bevin drained the last of his ale and scooped the uneaten coin crabs into a napkin to fold them up and pocket them.
You're my Mandalore, after all.
It might have been sarcasm. You sound very tribal these days.
Spirit of the times. Seems to be catching on.
Fett hadn't visited Mandalore or the surrounding sector for a couple of years. There was no reason why it should feel like home in the same way Kamino did. We don't even know how many Mandalorians there are in the galaxy. You don't need an ID or a birth certificate to be one of us. Bevin replaced his helmet and walked out without a backward glance. Without a drink in front of him, Fett had no reason to sit there any longer either. He slid off the stool, to the visible relief of the bar staff, and wandered back to Slave One, taking in the sights along the way. There was a share-dealing shop on the walkway. Upper City was full of them, open all hours to catch trading on the thousands of trading floors throughout the galaxy that made up the Interstellar Stock Exchange. Share-dealing had become an entertainment for the wealthy on this forgotten world. Fett paused and walked into the vividly lit lobby to stand in the constantly shifting interactive holodisplay of the various markets. Coruscant's CSX, its domestic stock index, had taken a sudden dip since he'd last checked the markets on his inbound journey. The little red line was still edging down against the top million ISE index. Something must have spooked the traders. It didn't take much. A bantha could belch and wipe billions off stock prices if the market was nervous enough. Fett stretched out a gloved finger and touched the index that read Biotech. A cascade of sub-indices tumbled out in a table, and he ignored Select Company to choose Volume Share Movement. That brought up the ranked list of companies where most shares had been traded over any given period. He chose one standard month. Three companies topped the list. Santec, Arcanian Micro, and Darumed. Arcanian Micro share prices hadn't shifted more than 10%, though, and they were always among the top-priced shares. It was Arumed that caught his eye. The green icon beside the name told him it was small and relatively new, but someone had bought a 25% block of its dirt-cheap shares in the last week.
Let's see what looked so appealing to them, then.
Fat checked the database that fed through to his helmet's internal display, but found nothing remarkable at all about the company's activities. Arumed had been trading for a year, and specialized in genetically tailored pharmaceuticals, and no dramatic new product seemed to be on the horizon to warrant speculative share buying.
Unless this is insider trading.
Unless someone knew the company had taken on a Kaminoan scientist recently, the shares wouldn't have been very appealing at all. Fett noted the assistant watching him with discreet concern. He probably didn't get too many customers with jetpacks and flamethrowers in the store. The database located Arumed's headquarters on Runadan. It seemed unusual for a small biotech company to be based in the corporate sector, under the nose of the aggressively acquisitive Chiwab Laboratories. So Fat recorded the details and went back to the holodisplay to browse general pharmaceutical companies. Only two more showed unusual share-dealing activity in the period since Town Wee had gone on the run, and one of those was Rothana-based Concare, which seemed to focus on drugs for older citizens.
Like me.
Kaminoans really didn't like being far from home. Rothana was within stone-throwing distance of Kamino in galactic terms. He made a special note to check that one out after Arumed.
"Care to invest, sir?"
said the assistant. Fat always did his share deals through his accountant, Puth, a Nimbanel who could launder and erase an audit trail almost as well as Fat himself. There was no point in having an accountant who was smarter than you were, after all. But even a bounty hunter could be prone to impulse buys. He took out a credit chip. "I'll take 50,000 shares in Steripak."
"They make battlefield dressings," said the assistant.
His fixed stare told Fat he rarely sold 100,000 credits worth of shares in one deal, and his hand folded around the chip as if he thought it would escape.
"Expecting a war?"
"Always. And I'm never disappointed."
Fat made his way to the sparsely furnished apartment he'd bought a year before that would not, for once in his life, become an asset that made a quick profit. Terrace wasn't a fast-moving property market, but it was worth paying for the relative privacy.
"So, someone sent Kosai home a piece at a time."
His helmet sensors told him a human was walking behind him, maintaining a constant distance.
"Kaminoans could easily have done a little forensics work on that, and figured out where the packages came from."
It was a young woman, 18 maybe, with dark curly hair cut close to her head. He could see the image in the HUD of his helmet, relayed from the rangefinder's rear view. And while she had a blaster holstered on one hip, who didn't go around armed these days, she looked neither local nor hostile. She was wearing gray body armor, basic chest and back plates like a Mandalorian, but without colors or markings.
"But she's following me. I know it."
So, if the Kaminoans knew who had grabbed Kosai, they had a very good reason for not going after them. And her research had never resurfaced. Fett was troubled when he couldn't spot motives. Everyone had a motive. Tomorrow, he'd set off for Runadan and give Puth a call. He needed to get his fortune in order in case he lost his race against time.
"What am I going to do with it?"
He always thought he'd know one day, until that one day was overtaken by bad news. Behind him, the girl quickened her pace and caught up with him, close enough now to reach out take two quick steps, and touch him. He turned before she could do it, and stood blocking her path, irritated. She didn't seem startled. She stared into his visor much as Bevin had, which was unusual in itself.
"You're Boba Fett," she said.
"You passed your eyesight test."
"I need to talk to you."
"Whatever it is, you can't afford me."
"But can you afford me?"
Fett thought for a moment that he'd really read her completely wrong. But she held out her clenched fist, palm up, and parted her fingers to reveal a flat disk of opalescent stone, gold shot with red, blue, and violet. A leather strip was threaded through a hole drilled on one edge. It was a heart of fire gemstone. He knew, because he had given one like it to Sintas Vel when they were married. It was from her home, from Khifu. He'd been just 16, Sintas not much older. No. He had given this very stone to her. This was the same gem. He could see the carved edge, like rope.
"Four lines of a Mandalorian marriage vow that we didn't understand. A stone that she sent had some part of my spirit and hers held in it forever."
Forever amounted to 3 years. They'd split up before Aelin was two. Sintas had gone bounty hunting when Aelin was 16 and never returned.
"That's why my own daughter was ready to kill me." "Where did you get this?"
he asked as calmly as he could. It was clear that the girl knew he would recognize it. There was no point bluffing. He didn't need to.
"From the man who killed your wife," she said. "Your daughter owes me a bounty, and I know exactly where she is."
Cards Tap Calf, Blue Sky Boulevard, Coronet. It was how you behaved that made the difference, Han decided. He sat in the tap calf facing the window and watched for Leia through the Rain Street transparasteel. He'd thought he'd be recognized at last, but once he'd got used to not striding purposefully and drawing attention to himself, and started to move like a regular person, matching everyone else's pace, shoulders relaxed, nobody seemed to notice him. He became just another Coronet citizen having a calf and whiling away the time on the boulevard. There was a holoscreen on the wall behind him, and Newsnet was running. Normally it washed over him as part of the background noise, but even over the hiss of steam from the calf machine at the bar, he heard very clearly the words "bomb" and "Corellian." So did everyone else in the tap calf. Silence fell. The staff even shut down the hissing calf pressure filter, and everyone turned in their seats or on their stools to watch the bulletin. The scenes from Coruscant were terrible. One hovercam shot, tracked down from a shattered hotel frontage where the remnants of a sign, just the letters ELI, hung from a dangling section of permacrete, clinging to the tower by a thin strand of durasteel reinforcing wire. The cam dropped level after level to the bottom of the urban canyon, showing less damage as it descended, but then settling on a shocking image of what had fallen finally to the ground level. Speeders, masonry, and bodies. Han, a man used to war, looked away and shut his eyes. The stunned silence gave way to debate among strangers brought together by common outrage.
"We didn't do that," said a woman.
"We fight clean.
If we wanted to bomb Coruscant, we'd use the fleet."
"They're blaming us. Why, don't they know us by now?"
No, terrorism wasn't Corellia's way of doing things. There was military sabotage, but Corellians tended to be pretty clear-cut about who was a legitimate target and who wasn't. Han wondered if the blast was a slick bit of black ops by Coruscant and the Alliance in general to polarize positions by bombing their own people.
"I'm going crazy. This is Luke I'm talking about.
The Jedi Council wouldn't let the Senate get away with it.
But there were all kinds of murky agencies that the Senate probably bankrolled and didn't keep too close an eye on for pragmatic, plausibly deniable reasons. Luke wouldn't even know. He was just the same decent, idealistic kid at heart that he'd always been.
They're going to use this so-called bomb outrage to up the ante, to take a crack at us.
Han put his head in his hands and sat there for a moment, wondering what he could possibly do now to help Corellia when he wasn't even welcome here. Eyes shut, he reached for the cup, and it wasn't quite where he thought he'd left it. Someone put a hand on his arm.
Han!
It was a man, and Han's instinct was to jerk his arm back and draw a blaster. But he stopped dead, hand a split second from his holster. The man was about 25, dark skin, black hair, cut almost military short, a stranger.
"Do you know me?"
Han was ready to drop him where he stood. "Because I don't know you, pal."
"But your wife knew my father."
"Ah, Gedgen. No, play it cool. You have no idea who this guy is at all."
"Prove it." Han saw familiar movement outside the window, and Leia, the hood of her tunic, pulled up against light rain. "How did you find us?" Gedgen, if that was who he was, dropped his voice almost to a whisper.
"When you rented the apartment, you paid in untrackable credits. That's a lot of hard currency. Unusual enough to draw attention right now."
"From who?"
"From our own security forces."
"So Korsak knows we're here and Thrakken doesn't?" Han nearly spat out the name. Luckily, it was a common enough first name not to draw the same attention that snarling Sal Solo would have done.
"Right. Try again."
"You're assuming that everyone in Korsak would want to tell Thrakken."
Han shook his head slowly. "Why do I get the feeling that I don't want to know then?"
"Well, there's Corellia, and there's Thrakken, and they're not the same thing in many people's eyes. People who'd like to do something about it."
"Call me cynical, but I think you're talking about a change of administration without an election. I'm trying to remember the word for that." Gedgen, he could be nobody else, sat down next to him. As Leia came into the tap calf, she stared at Han, and then at Gedgen, and her lips parted as if she had realized something that quite pleased her.
"You're the image of your father," she said. "Dear Gedgen," said the young man very quietly.
He held out his hand for shaking, and their voices were lost in the chatter that had swamped the tap calf again.
"At your service, ma'am."
"Hi, honey," said Han. "This nice young man is about to ask me to take part in a coup." He smiled theatrically at Gedgen. "Did I get the right word?"
"I asked him to meet us here,"
Leia said quietly,
"but he's early." "Apologies. It's a habit. Just in case messages are ever intercepted. Shall we move on?"
Gedgen indicated the door.
"You can choose the location, just to reassure you in case you think I'm setting you up."
"Good idea,"
said Leia.
"I know just the place."
She beckoned to Han. He rolled his eyes, but gulped down the remains of his calf, and followed her out into the rain, staying to one side of Gedgen so he could keep an eye on him. Leia led them to a women's fashion store.
"There goes my tough guy image," said Han, hesitating at the ornately gilded doors.
"Turbolift," said Leia, gesturing both men inside with an expression of narrow-eyed mock impatience.
Under the circumstances, she seemed in a good mood.
"There's a calf bar on the top floor. Nice and public, with several exits if anything happens that we're not expecting."
Gedgen took the suspicion aimed at him pretty well.
"Sensible precaution,"
he said. Han knew he'd never enjoy calf again in quite the same way, because the taste was starting to become inextricably linked in his subconscious with bad news. They huddled around a table, surrounded by chattering shoppers and noisy children, and tried to look unremarkable. The ubiquitous holoscreen murmured away on one wall. Corellians were addicted to news. There was no getting away from that bomb blast.
"Okay, where were we?" said Han. "Ah, I remember. Removing the elected government. Go ahead and amaze me, kid." He offered Gedgen a small jug. "Cream, sugar?"
"Han!" Leia fixed him with a stare.
"Sorry, honey."
He leaned back and folded his arms.
"Go on, Gedgen."
The young man was still totally unperturbed.
"You're at risk, and so is Corellium. From the same source."
"Power-crazed galactic government?"
"Power-crazed individuals."
"That's half the galaxy on a good day."
"Sir, your cousin isn't doing anybody any favors."
"I didn't choose my family."
"Well, he's going to kill yours, because he's put out a contract on you, your wife, and your children. And if he carries on the way he's going, he's also going to get a lot of Corellians killed in a war we can't win."
Han still didn't know what use they were to Gedgen, but he took an instant dislike to phrases like "can't win." "So you want us to do something?" "See, I have this hunch that you do."
"If Thraken is removed, would you consider taking his place?"
"Oh, boy." "No." Even Leia looked taken aback.
"Absolutely not," she said.
"Yeah, I already said that, honey." Gedgen managed a nervous smile.
"I didn't mean to embarrass you, sir."
"I'll do anything for Corellia," said Han. "And I agree that Thraken's conducting his own war for his own ends, like he always does. But there's a real threat out there from the Alliance, and it is going to take a united Corellia to stand up to it. Just give me a blaster, not an office."
"You're not going back to Coruscant, then?"
"Why should I? We're not running from Thraken." Han slipped his hand under the table and caught Leia's hand. She gave it a squeeze that threatened to numb his fingers. "And we're not going to live in hiding on Coruscant, either. Might as well be here."
"I understand."
"Fine.
The good news is that Thraken seems to think you're on Coruscant."
"Well, that's another good reason for staying put, isn't it?"
"When we find out who's taken the contract, we'll warn you."
Gedgen stood up and shook their hands. He had a mature, solid air about him, an elder statesman in a young man's body.
"If you'd like to help relocate, you know where to find me. If we could track you, so might others."
"I think I already know who'll find me." Han watched Gedgen leave. When he was sure the man had disappeared into the turbo lift, he turned to Leia. "Well, you didn't say much for a hot-shot diplomat."
"It's not appropriate for a Jedi to discuss political coups."
"Yeah, I can understand how that might be a sensitive area. How did you trace him?"
"I looked up Gedgen in the comlink directories."
Han laughed out loud. A large woman in a bright orange suit that really didn't do her any favors turned to look at him for a second. "Funny, we always think this is cloak-and-dagger stuff."
"Gedgen doesn't need to hide. He's an elected representative of a legal political party, the Democratic Alliance. They have a lot of seats in the Corellian Assembly now. With the Corellian Liberal Front, they actually form the largest block of votes. But Thraken's still hanging on."
"If that dirtbag comes anywhere near you or the kids, I'll kill him, I swear."
"You think he's got a chance? Taking on 3 Jedi?"
"He won't. Contract, remember?"
"You think it's going to be Fett, don't you?"
"Yeah."
"No, not Fett. Why would he? He saved us from the Vong."
"Because business is business, maybe." Han could feel something rising in his chest, and it wasn't the effect of way too much calf. It was something animal and irrational. Something that was making his pulse pound in his temples. It was anger and fear, not for himself, though, but for Leia, Jaina, and Jason. "Thraken's done some dirty things, but he never went this far before. Not hiring hitmen, that changes everything." He had a thought, and it was one that almost made him recoil. "I'm going to kill this scumbag this time. Nobody touches my family." Leia reacted as if he'd said it aloud.
No, you're not going to contact Fett, and you're not going to hire him to hit your cousin.
That never entered my mind, said Han, and it really hadn't. She could see that, and she could feel it, too. He knew. Unfortunately, he knew he'd have a hard job concealing the fact that he still felt murderously protective. Besides, I haven't had to deal with guys like that in a long time. Maybe you place a want ad in Bounty Hunter Weekly these days. Or call their agents.
Yes, so remember we can take care of ourselves, said Leia. I'll just warn Jason and Jaina.
Jason. Han kept missing him every time he called or returned a message. He really wanted to talk to him now, and not to remonstrate with him. He just wanted to hear Jason's voice. Whatever insanity had put them on opposite sides of a divide, Jason was his little boy, and always would be, no matter how old or powerful or distant he might be. Nobody touches my wife and kids. Han Solo wasn't one of the galaxy's natural assassins. He would fight to defend himself, but he'd never gone after anyone with the intention of killing them. There was always a first time. This would be his. Lost in his thoughts, Han stirred the remains of his calf with a spoon, wondering how they got the foam to last that long, and then was jerked out of his trance by the one thing guaranteed to get anyone's attention, his own name. The words Han Solo cut through the hubbub of voices and children's squealings, as if the tap calf had fallen into total and complete silence for a moment.
In a statement issued by the Office of the State, President Sal Solo has declared Han Solo and his family to be enemies of Corellia, following the attacks on Centerpoint and Relidir, and he's ordered their arrest, said the HNE hollow anchor.
Han tried not to swing around in his seat or curse at the screen. He raised his head very slowly, caught Leia's eye, and focused on the screen as if bored. No, he wasn't bored at all. He was furious and a little scared. He wondered how good an actor he was, but nobody seemed to be looking at him. It was probably because the image on the screen was of a younger Han, a man still with brown hair and relatively few lines. The picture of Leia was way out of date, too.
"I think we'd better be going," said Leia. "Some urgent laundry."
"Right behind you," said Han. He didn't like running, and there was nowhere safer to run. Coruscant wasn't going to welcome him with open arms either. Either way, they were fugitives. They split up as soon as they left the store and met up again back at the apartment.
"Have I changed that much?" said Leia.
"What?"
"The picture of me that they're running."
"I hope so," said Han. Maybe he should have assured her she looked as good as ever to him. But he thought that practical reassurance about her safety was more important than flattery right then. "And I'm going to grow a beard, just in case. How about you?" Leia gave him a withering stare.
"I didn't shave today. You didn't notice?"
"I meant change your hair or something."
"The Aura Sing look?"
"Yes, it's so me." "I'm glad you've kept your sense of humor."
"You know what they say," said Leia, and took scissors from the kitchen. "If you can't take a joke, you shouldn't have joined."